The standard of living of the average American worker is certain to drop for a sustained period of time. This is the inevitable, if unintended, consequence of a policy permitting a chronic trade imbalance. Those are the words of economist Jeff Foh. For the last 2.5 decades, the U.S. has been importing substantially more than it exports. Central banks in South Korea, Japan, China, and elsewhere have stepped in to fill the ever-widening breach by lending money to the United States so that Americans can keep buying goods from abroad. Many mainstream as well as left economists are growing increasingly concerned that this may set up Americans for a hard comedown if investors overseas decide they no longer want to keep propping up the United States to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. Jeff Foh is the founder and former president of the Economic Policy Institute and the author of The Global Class War, How America's Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back, published by Wiley. When I spoke to him recently, I began by asking him why the trade deficit has grown and why it should concern us.
Well, it's a reflection of the lack of competitiveness of the American economy. And by American economy, I mean the people who produce the goods and services here. When we're essentially buying more from the rest of the world than we're selling. And, you know, you can only do that for so long. The trade deficit now, you know, these are billions of dollars, comes to between $750 and $800 billion every year. So that's the amount that we're buying over the amount that we're selling. And as a country, we are making up for this by borrowing. So we're borrowing $750, $800 billion a year from the rest of the world in order for us to buy the goods from the rest of the world. Now, we've gotten away with this for a couple of decades because the U.S. dollar has this sort of unique status in the world. We're no longer on the gold standard the way we were in the old days. So people will accept U.S. dollars. And they will accept a lot of U.S. dollars, much more than other currencies. So, and the reason they accept U.S. dollars is, you know, we won World War II, and we ended up being the most important financial country in the world. So having said all that, the problem is you cannot continue to do this. And you can just put it in very personal terms. You know that you cannot continue to buy more than to spend more than you make. You can do it for a while. You can you can put it on your credit cards. If you own a house, you can go to the bank and get another mortgage on it. You can refinance this. You can skip a payment to the bank. So, but sooner or later, as you continue to do this, the banks come to call. So. That the way it is with individuals is the way it's going to be with this country, and it sort of explains a mystery. If you look at the numbers, sort of an economic and political mystery in this country. If you look at the numbers, it's clear that real wages for the average American worker have been stagnant. For many of them, they've been declining. We've got this huge trade deficit. We are outsourcing jobs. You know, as we speak, there are more jobs being closed down here in the United States and opening up in other places. So the numbers tell us that the country's in trouble. But for the average American, the average voter, sort of looking around at his or her world, things still look pretty good. You go to the shopping mall, and there's a whole lot of people buying things. You go to Starbucks, and there's people lined up to pay $4 for a cup of coffee. So America, looks pretty good. And, you ask, how can it be that all these numbers are telling us one thing, and the evidence, apparently, of our own eyes are telling us something else? And the answer to that is primarily debt. People in the mall are doing it with credit cards. The whole country is essentially floating in a sea of debt. And the way it works is we buy the more goods from overseas than we sell. The customer goes into the store and, you know, buys the sneakers on a credit card. Essentially, the bank is providing a loan to that customer. The profits from the sales go to China, let's say, or someplace else, in dollars. The Chinese then lend the dollars back to the bank in order to lend to the consumer so that they can buy more Chinese sneakers. I mean, that's the sort of the way the system works. But again, that consumer is putting himself more and more in debt every time he or she goes to the mall. And, Herb Stein, who was Richard Nixon's chief economist, once famously said, if something can't go on forever, it probably won't. And this will not go on forever.
Well, the example of U.S. consumers is not just a symbolic parallel, but actually intrinsically connected to what we're talking about. Can you explain that connection?
Yeah, well, it's that in order to the trade deficit means that we're importing more than we're exporting. And how are we importing? We're importing. I mean, you go to the store, and there are more and more goods made overseas. Fewer and fewer goods made in America. So every time an American, you know, buys a foreign good, that adds to the import bill. And so there's a connection between what happens in the store and this trade deficit. And you add up all those bills, you add up all those sneakers and all that, all that underwear and all those electronic gadgets and all of this, all the steel we used to make in America, the automobiles we used to make here, the appliances, et cetera. You add that all up, and you get imports that are growing much faster than our exports. That is what we sell to other countries. In fact, as your listeners probably know, there are a whole lot of things we don't make anymore in America. We don't make television sets. We don't make appliances. We don't make telephones. So that the country as a whole is buying more than it's selling, and borrowing from the rest of the world in order to make up for it. Now that borrowing comes in many ways. Some of it comes in loans. Bush has aggravated this problem, obviously, by cutting all these taxes and creating deficits, which means the federal government goes to the Chinese to borrow money now. Mm-hmm. And it also, they also can use dollars for something else. They can use it to buy up American businesses and American assets, which is one of the reasons that you go through the business pages and all of these brands that used to be American turn out now to be owned by foreigners. You may or may not think that's a problem, but it adds to the flow of profits that are now going overseas. So, all of this is, as I say, is a sea of debt. And it's not the consumer's fault. The consumer, after all, a lot of these goods are no longer made in the United States. But the accumulation, daily accumulation of these imports, and the lack of since we don't buy so much stuff here, we don't sell it overseas. That combination is economically just deadly.
And that's the voice of Jeff Foh, economist and author of The Global Class War. His last name is spelled F-A-U-X. So the U.S. current account deficit, which is the trade deficit plus transfer payments and some other flows, amounts to 6% of the value of goods and services of the entire U.S. economy. How does this compare to other industrialized nations and to the history of the United States?
Well, it's very, very high. The International Monetary Fund uses 5% as the measure of a country in deep trouble. You know, when Argentina started to go down, it was at 5% and growing. And the International Monetary Fund and the world's bankers, you know, pounced on Argentina. So 5% is sort of the rule of thumb of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. In terms of history, when the United States was growing in the 19th century and, you know, just developing, it borrowed a lot of money from the rest of the world. But it also had a trade surplus. It made up, you know, it paid back the money it borrowed by earning more from the sale of its goods. And historically, our trade balances, our trade has pretty much been in balance throughout the 20th century until about 25 years ago when it started to tank. And the problem is that it is getting worse. Let me put it this way. For every percentage increase in income in America, the trade deficit and our international debt rises by an even greater amount. So, you know, if incomes in America go up 1%, the debt essentially is going up by more than 1%. 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, and you start stretching this stuff out. And again, it's like somebody who's maxed out on their credit cards. It's real trouble. The other interesting thing about this is that you know, as we know, over the last decade, and especially with the Bush administration, a word that used to appear only at the sort of margin of left-wing intellectuals, that is the American Empire, is now is now the sort of a currency of political discussion in Washington. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, or at least over the last decade, people on the right have been triumphant in talking about an American empire. And you read these neoconservatives, and they make a lot of parallels between ourselves and the British in the 19th century, which had, of course, this huge empire. But a critical economic distinction is the British were always net creditors to the world. The United States is now the world's biggest debtor. And you can't run an empire in this world by being the biggest debtor. You can't rule the world if you're the biggest borrower and dependent on the rest of the world for loans and, you know, and this kind of financial assistance. You know, somebody who's going to be the world's biggest deadbeat eventually is not going to wield the kind of power that the people in Washington expect us to wield.
Well, you just said that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, gets worried about an economy when the percentage of GDP of the trade deficit is a point less than it is for the U.S. right now. So is there any chance, do you think, that the IMF will step in and compel the U.S.
No.
to adopt structural adjustment policy?
No, because the United States government is the major influence on the IMF. The technical people at the IMF have been warning us about this problem for the last 2 or 3 years. Whatever else you might think about them, they're not stupid. And they could see what's happening, and they're also, people at the World Bank are also worried about another aspect of this, and that is the rich countries like the United States in a global economy, they are the ones that are supposed to be providing the investment, providing the credit to poor countries around the world. Now the United States is sucking up the credit that poor countries need for their own development. And so the technical people in these agencies are worried, but the U.S. holds, you know, the most votes at the IMF. The United States always furnishes the president of the World Bank, and of course we take people who have failed in disastrous wars, from McNamara to Paul Wolfowitz, and we make them position of the United States, in effect, is precluding taking steps in order to that are needed in order to rectify the situation. And of course, the people in Washington are in complete denial. By the way, this is not just some left-wing economist talking. I mean, this is the people on Wall Street understand this. Paul Volcker, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, as you know, said a couple of years ago that he thought because of this, there was a 75% chance of, and this is his word, catastrophe within the next 5 years. So we have 3 years to go. Even someone who is a champion of globalization, like Greg Mankiw, who was George Bush's chief economist until recently, he was asked by the Wall Street Journal a few months ago about all this, and he said, we're going to get through this. I said, but of course, the country's not going to be as prosperous as it was. And so among people who look at this, it's clear that at some point we are going to have a crisis. Now, the economists argue as to whether it's going to be what they call a hard landing or a soft landing. Hard landing is when the dollar collapses, interest rates go sky high, and a country gets plunged into a depression. Soft landing is when the dollar goes down gradually, interest rates go up gradually, so the pain just sort of comes step by step. But either way, the real message here is that this means that living standards for the average American are going to be hammered. At some point, we as a country are going to have to start to stop consuming more than we're making. And, right now the economy is floating on the borrowing that gets translated into consumer spending. So we've got ourselves in a situation where we're not paying our way in the world. And again, like anybody else who's finally confronted with debts rising faster than income, you got to start, tightening your belt. We haven't, as a nation and in our political consciousness, we have not faced this yet. James Baldwin once said, not everything that is faced can be fixed, but you can't fix anything unless you face it. And we are going through a great deal of denial, both parties, both Republicans and Democrats. One of the reasons for that, in addition to the fact that politicians in general don't want to be bearers of bad news, so they're pretty reluctant to get up there and say, this country is heading off over a cliff. Although you'd think that the Democrats would be more willing to say this than the Republicans. But the other part of the problem is that the current situation is benefiting long-term a number of interests, and the biggest are Wall Street interests. If you ask yourself, well, who benefits from this dollar that's kept artificially high by this recycling of dollars from China and other places? Well, it's people who would like to use their dollars to buy assets in other countries. And that's exactly what Wall Street's doing. It's exactly what major transnational corporations with American names are doing. The outsourcing of jobs is occurring in large measure because American corporations are building facilities, investing in things in other places. Now, if you want to buy something in South America or Asia or Europe with American dollars, you want those dollars to be as valuable as possible. And so, part of what's going on is the people who are using those dollars to buy up factories and other things overseas want the dollar to continue, you know, as long as it can, and they want to get as they want to be spending those dollars to buy up assets in other countries as long as they can. The Pentagon also benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, we have 725. This is before 9/11, as Chalmers Johnson wrote an excellent book on this. As he pointed out, we had 725 military bases around the world. This is 12 years after the Cold War is over, and this was before 9/11. And it's a lot cheaper to run those bases. You know, if you've got this high dollar. And in order to, and once this problem of our debt is faced, then we know we're going to have to start getting that dollar down. So these people would, you know, just want to keep this thing going as long as they can, knowing that at some point it's going to deflate.
We're talking today about the state of the U.S. economy in relationship to the rest of the world, particularly the massive imbalance between U.S. imports and exports, and what the potential consequences of this imbalance might be for average Americans and the global economy. I'm joined by phone from Washington, D.C. by Jeff Foe. He's the author of The Global Class War, How America's Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back, published by Wiley. Jeff, you were just talking about the consequences of an unraveling of the strength of the U.S. dollar if the dollar started to devalue. But in your book, you make an argument about the central role that the United States plays for the ruling classes of other countries. Would countries like Japan, South Korea, and China that depend on an overvalued dollar so that Americans can keep buying their exports really allow a devaluation of the dollar? Would that be in their best interests?
Well, it's not in their best. It's not in their best interests, but the devaluation is inevitable. In other words, it's going to be a hard landing or a soft landing. You know, at some point, and everything we know about economics and economic history has told us this. At some point, it's like, you know, it's a little bit like the stock market in 1999, when you turn on the radio and there were these stories of people selling, you know, massive amount of stock for millions and millions of dollars on companies that didn't exist, that were just a post office box someplace. And, you know, people sort of laughed at that, and it was the butt of jokes on Jay Leno, and everyone sort of understood that this could not go on. That at some point, you know, the somebody would say the emperor doesn't have any clothes. Well, of course, that finally happened, but nobody knew when. And the speculative money, and it's, you know, is just natural human nature to keep wanting to keep the good times roll until, you know, as long as possible. So the Chinese and the Japanese at this point, and others, it's not just the Chinese and Japanese, but we are in hock to people all over the world. It's in their interests, but what the way this works is that as more and more dollars are out there in the hands of a variety of people, not just the Bank of China, who, you know, we have the phone number, we could call up and say, hey, please, you know, we'll lay off on Taiwan, or we'll lay off on North Korea, but, you know, don't pull the plug. But more and more, you have more and more people out there, and you can't control everybody who holds these dollars. And the way it usually works is that some event happens, the stock market, you know, drops, or there's an oil crisis or whatever. And, you know, you're going to have two or three oil crises, and then the fourth one, that's the when it pops. And the stock market can go up and down, and then one day it goes down, and somebody panics in Korea and sells a lot of dollars. And then the people in China look at this and say, well, we better bail out of this market. And then the people of Japan say, I mean, that is just the history of how these kinds of markets work. So it is definitely, you know, it's going to go down. And it's in there, they, like the Wall Street people, would like to keep it going as long as possible. But, you know, there's just no, there's no one can make a case that at some point this will not pop. Now, does that mean it'll happen next month or next year? We don't know. But the time is clearly getting closer and closer.
Well, in 1985, Europe and Japan agreed to go along with basically a planned devaluation of the dollar in relation to the German Deutschmark and the Japanese yen. Could something like that happen now, a planned soft landing, essentially?
Yes, it could happen. And there are people who say, well, you know, at some point, central banks of the world will get together and they'll all bail us out like they did then. But there are several major, major differences between the situation now and the situation in 1985. One is the Cold War is over. So in the 1980s, no one in the Western world wanted to see the country that was protecting them against the Soviet Union be hurt. Right? They wanted to keep a strong America. And of course, for the Europeans, the more Americans spent on the military to protect against the Soviets, the less the Europeans had to spend. But at any rate, the Cold War was with us, and the upper classes in Europe and in China and in Japan, it was Europe and Japan, were willing to protect us. That's no longer the case now. And number two, you've got the increase in just popular anti-Americanism in many of these countries. So the notion that, let's take, you know, the European Union, or let's take France or Germany, or let's take Germany, which was very important in bailing us out last time. The notion that the German politicians are going to go to the German people now and say, well, the Americans have been living high on the hog. You know, they've been borrowing and they've been spending on themselves, and now they're in trouble, and we are going to force the euro up so the dollar can come down and the Americans can sell us more goods, and which means we're selling them less goods. You know, that's going to be a very, very hard sell. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And then the third thing is the numbers are so much larger now. You know, the trade deficit back there was quite modest. I mean, we're talking about less than $100 billion, much less than $100 billion, something like, you know, 40 or 50. And now it's around $800 billion and rising. That's the problem. As I say, that it's sort of built in to the economy, because as Americans, as their income goes up, they spend a disproportionate amount of that on foreign goods. And, you know, one reason, as I said before, is that we no longer make so many of these things. So it's like you know, going up a down escalator. You can do it for a while if you run really fast, but in the end, you're going to go down.
Well, some people might think, as you have alluded to, that the U.S. has made its bed and now it has to lie in it. Why should anyone outside of the U.S., particularly in the developing world, care about a devaluation of the dollar?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that for the developing world, there are two things in it for them, and that is there'll be more money available in the world if the United States wasn't soaking it all up, more capital, and that'd be good for the developing world. Secondly, the United States, when this crisis comes, if it unravels in a way that's not, you know, that doesn't get out of hand and not grotesque. The leadership in Washington is going to have to spend more time worrying about the domestic economy and the problems here, and less time running around the world imposing its dreamlike notions of laissez-faire capitalism on everybody else. So the answer to the question is, why should others care? In the short run, it's going to be a bumpy ride, but that's inevitable. In the long run, when the U.S. is forced to reverse its trade deficit, it's going to be better for everybody.
And that is Jeff Foh. He's Distinguished Fellow at the Economic Policy Institute, the think tank he created and directed from 1985 to 2002. He's the author of Fast Track, Fast Shuffle, Rebuilding America, and most recently The Global Class War, which was published by Wiley. Well, you have been speaking about the dominance of the dollar and its particular place as a reserve currency for the world, partly because of the strength of the U.S. empire. How significant has been the threat to the dollar of the euro as an alternate reserve currency?
Oh, I think it's increasing. When the euro first came out in the mid-90s, it dropped, and there was a lot of skepticism about the euro. But it is now, selling for about $1.30, $1.28, $1.27. The euro is stronger than the dollar, and as it as people around the world, financiers, central bankers, have watched the euro, they're starting to make the case to themselves and to each other that the euro is a more stable currency than the dollar. One of the big reasons is that the Europeans aren't running this huge trade deficit. You know, Europe has its problems, but it is not this huge it's not a huge debtor. So the long-term outlook for the euro is, I think most people would think, is that it's stronger than the long-term outlook for the dollar. And, therefore, you're seeing more countries around the world begin to diversify their reserves, so that countries that had 100% of their central bank reserves in dollars are now starting to use euros. The contracts in oil, which had been almost exclusively made in dollars for decades, are now increasingly being made in euros. So that little by little, the euro is, you know, we're not talking about supplanting the dollar. Probably 10 years from now, there'll be balance here. People will hold dollars, people will hold euros. But the supreme hegemony of economic hegemony of the U.S. dollar, I think, is a thing of the past. Early this year, I think it was this year or late last year, a Chinese official mentioned that the Chinese central bank was beginning to diversify to euros, and it caused a 24-hour panic. And then he said, "No, I was, you know," and he had said when the original statement indicated, or implicit in his statement, was that they were going to continue to do that, and they were going to use euros more and dollars less. So he backtracked because everybody got nervous, and the stock markets went down. But, you know, the truth is that this is happening, and it's bound to happen because, again, the Europeans are paying their way in the world. As a European Union, they've been roughly in trade balance. You know, every year you have some surplus, and next year a little deficit, but basically in balance. Whereas we not only have this large deficit, but the deficit is getting larger and larger, and so it's in many ways people are looking at this and saying this thing is out of control.
Well, in your book, The Global Class War, you talk about empire and the relationship between what you call the party of Davos, the neoliberal elites around the world whose fortunes have been very much wrapped up with the fortunes of the elites in the United States. What would a massive devaluation of the dollar do to U.S. imperial ambitions, given that, as you say, it allows the U.S. to cheaply set up military bases around the world and the like?
Yeah. Well, two points there. First, what I call the party of Davos, they're all getting nervous. During the Clinton years, this problem was not solved, but it was moderated because Clinton was moving towards a surplus in the U.S. government accounts. You know, our budget, our national budget, was moving towards surplus. Now, I think many people saw that as a betrayal of his promises to support more social programs, etc. And it was, in a sense, and he was using the budget. He was creating a budget surplus in order to counteract the borrowing that's going on in the private sector. So there was this was happening, but it was slower. With Bush comes in and blows the federal budget in order to pay for his tax cuts and his military spending. So the problem is accelerated, and the smart people around the world see this. I think that all this is making them nervous. It's making the technical people at the IMF and the World Bank nervous. It's making, you know, people like Soros and Warren Buffett and people like that nervous. So the party of Davos, is starting to get very anxious about the behavior of its leading member, that is the United States elites. Second question about what happens militarily. Well, you know, it's very interesting. Up until now, the United States empire, if you will, rested on two pillars. One was its financial clout, the American financial clout in the world, and the other was its military clout. What I'm suggesting is one of those pillars, its financial clout, is crumbling. It will make it more expensive to have military adventures around the world. So the military part of it will also be affected. On the other hand, you can argue that with our financial leverage gone, if the attitude of the Washington elite still persists in trying to, you know, create and maintain an American empire, the only thing they have left is the military. So it could be a very dangerous time. My guess, nobody knows the future, but my guess is that the military, given the debacle in Iraq, given the hugely expensive military buildup that we've got, the military arm of U.S. imperialism is going to be blunted as well. But I'm less certain about that than I am about the financial side.
Sure. What sort of policies do you think could rectify this state of affairs in terms of the larger economic picture? What sort of policies would you like to see put in place?
Well, the first thing is you stop the hemorrhaging. And, we are still creating all of these trade agreements around the world. Every year there's new ones. And each time we do it, whether it's NAFTA or the WTO or the entry of China or whatever, each time we do, our trade deficit gets worse and worse. So the first thing You know, if I was the Speaker of the House in a Democratic Congress in January, the first thing I would do is say we're not going to do any more of these deals. The second thing is that we've got to get the dollar down gradually, which means we're going to have to make concessions to other people around the world in order to get them to help us, and it's going to be a lot more difficult than it was in the 1980s. The third thing that we've got to do is switch away from this mindless sort of free trade regime that we've been pursuing, and understand that trade is just like anything else. It has to be managed. The issue is not whether we, you know, buy and sell with other countries. We've been doing that for ever since we began as a nation, and we'll continue to do that. I've got a cup of coffee in front of me, and that was probably grown in Brazil or Colombia, so it's natural to trade with other people. But we have gone off the deep end on this trade, and in part because it's American corporations that are financing and providing the technology and involved in these imports. You know, 40% of American trade is within one company. So as companies outsource, they're outsourcing to themselves. 66% of all Chinese imports to this country are financed by U.S. and other multinationals. So we have to start managing our trade. And the number one priority we need to do now is to eliminate the trade deficit. We also need to begin a industrial strategy that would bring manufacturing back in America. Now, as soon as I start talking like that, somebody says, "Oh, what is he talking about? That's the past. Manufacturing in them, you know, is sort of old style economics." The reality is, when you look at these numbers, that we are going to have to manufacture more in the United States, because it's only through things that we manufacture can we start selling more to the rest of the world that we're buying, or at least balance that account out.
So you're saying that a lot of what the U.S. actually imports are manufactured goods that it can produce
yes.
here.
Yeah, and let me give you a clear example, at least clear to me, of what we need to do. Right now, the government is spending a huge amount of money to universities and around the country for research and development that's aimed at creating products of the future. So the taxpayers' money is being used for this. Now, the people who are going to benefit are the corporations who have these arrangements with Harvard or Stanford or University of Michigan to get the products of these inventions, you know, the products of the R&D. And they intend, of course, to produce them elsewhere. So the average American worker is first taking it in the neck because wages are stagnant and they've got to keep borrowing and working harder in order to keep their living standards up. And second, their tax dollars are being used to finance the development of products that will be made in other countries and further take away their jobs. We need to make sure that if research and development is done with taxpayers' money, then the product gets produced in the United States. Now, I notice some people's ears, this sounds awfully jingoistic, you know. But the problem is that we are stuck in this this economic downdraft, and it's better for the world if we put our books back in order. And I think it's going to happen one way or another. We are going to start selling more than we're buying, either because incomes in America are going to be pushed down so low and wages so low that we're going to become a low wage, a low wage producer. So, you know, that's what the market will do. If we plan,
and which is already happening in the service sector.
Oh, it's happening all over. It's people look at the wages. The wages, in real terms, have been stagnant, but also the benefits. I mean, we're cutting back on health care, we're cutting back on pensions, we're cutting back on the basic stability and security of the American worker. And we can either do it. We can either get out of this hole by planning it and taking steps to turn our trade deficit around in a way that minimizes pain on the average worker, and to start slicing down our debts, or the market's going to force us to do it, and it's going to be. I mean, neither one is a happy prospect, but that's because we've got ourselves in this hole, and either we start, I guess digging is the wrong metaphor. Either we start hoisting ourselves out of this hole, or we're going to get deeper and deeper.
Well, just taking your example of public institutions like universities essentially subsidizing companies that may then go and take the research from those public institutions and set up factories overseas. One could say that's the issue, but really, shouldn't the focus be on public subsidies of corporations who may also pay their workers very low wages in the United States? I mean, is the outsourcing the problem, or is it something to do with the profit motive of private companies?
Right. Well, there's two points there. Yes. I mean, this is as the old saying goes, this is death by a thousand cuts. So there's no one thing that's going to turn this around. But it's absolutely true that government policy has been encouraging the movement out of the country of jobs, and here's how I think that works. Because companies can now threaten credibly workers that unless you take a pay cut, unless you agree that we're going to get rid of this health care plan, unless you agree to fund pensions on your own without the company, then we're going to move overseas. Now, they could have said that 25 years ago, but it wasn't a credible threat. Now it's a credible threat. And so you've got what sort of unregulated globalization. Again, it's not about people trading with each other. That's not the problem. But it's like an unregulated market anywhere. The unregulated market in the 19th century in the United States created the robber baron era and poverty and misery and labor conflict, class conflict. The unregulated global market is doing the same thing. So that the corporations are using the threat. In many cases, they're not going to go to Mexico or they're not going to go to China, but the threat has become much more credible. So we need public policies that get back on the side of the worker in this shift of bargaining power from workers to capital that globalization has created. So for example, we should not be providing tax breaks for these people. We should not be providing subsidies for the creation of products that they can enjoy and profit from overseas. And we ought to have a series of social supports so that workers are not, alone when they confront the boss in this global marketplace.
I've been speaking with Jeff Foh, founder and former president of the Economic Policy Institute and the author of The Global Class War, How America's Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Take It Back.
And that was Sasha Lilly from KPFA's Against the Grain. Their website is againstthegrain.org, and the Economic Policy Institute can be found on the web at epi.org. I'd like to conclude by reading you an article that makes me weirdly hopeful because of who its author is. He is one of the architects of Reaganomics, an economist who was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in that administration, and a self-described conservative. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts is calling on the world to collapse the U.S. economy he helped create in an article published on February 12th in the newsletter Counterpunch at counterpunch.org, proving that minds can be changed, and in a big way. Roberts wrote, "Dump the dollar, how the world can stop Bush." What would be the consequences of a U.S. or Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear energy sites? At the 2006 Pradhana Global Peace Forum, Australian medical scientist Dr. Helen Caldicott provided an authoritative analysis of the devastating impact on human life that would result from the radiation release from such an attack. Dr. Caldicott described the catastrophic deaths that would result from a conventional attack on nuclear facilities and the long-term increase in cancer deaths from the radiation release. Should the attack be made with nuclear weapons, as some of Bush's criminally insane neoconservative advisors advocate, the populations of many countries would suffer for generations from radioactive particles in air, water, and food chains. Deaths would number in the many millions. Such an attack, justified in the name of, quote, American security and American hegemony, would constitute the rawest form of evil the world has ever seen, far surpassing in evil the atrocities of the Nazi and communist regimes. Dr. Caldicott detailed the horrible long-term consequences for the Iraqi population from the U.S. military's current use of depleted uranium in explosive ammunition used in Iraq. Caldicott explained that depleted does not mean depleted of radiation. She explained that each time such ammunition is used, radioactive particles are released in the air and are absorbed into people's lungs. We are yet to see the horrific civilian casualty rate of the American invasion, or the true casualty rate amongst U.S. troops. Dr. Caldicott expressed bewilderment why the rest of the world does not stand up to the U.S. and force a halt to its crimes against humanity. One man heard her, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia. On February 10th at the 43rd Munich Security Conference, President Putin told the world's assembled political leaders that the U.S. was trying to establish a unipolar world, which he defined as one single center of power, one single center of force, and one single master, close quote. This goal, Putin said, was a formula for disaster. The United States, Putin said truthfully, has overstepped its borders in all spheres and has imposed itself on other states. The Russian leader declared, "We see no kind of restraint, a hyperinflated use of force," close quote. To avoid catastrophe, Putin said a reconsideration of the entire existing architecture of global security was necessary. Putin's words fell on many deaf ears. U.S. Senator John McCain, America's most idiotic and dangerous, quote, leader after Bush and Cheney, equated Putin's legitimate criticism of the U.S. with confrontation. America's new puppets, the states of Central and Eastern Europe, and the Secretary General of NATO, no longer a treaty for the defense of Europe, but a military force enlisted in America's quest for empire, lined up with McCain's argument that Russia was in fundamental conflict with, quote, the core values of Euro-Atlantic democracies, close quote. Even the BBC's defense and security correspondent Rob Watson jumped on the American propaganda bandwagon, tagging Putin's speech a revival of the Cold War. No delegate at the security conference stood up to state the obvious fact that it is not Russia that is invading countries under pretexts as false as Hitler's and setting up weapon systems on foreign soil in order to achieve military hegemony. The reception given to Putin's words made it clear to Russia, China, and every country not bribed, threatened, or purchased into participation in America's drive for world hegemony that the U.S. has no interest whatsoever in peace. Intelligent people realize that American claims to be a moral and democratic force are mere pretense behind which hides a policy of military aggression. The U.S., Putin said, has gone from one conflict to another without achieving a fully fledged solution to any of them. Putin has repeatedly stressed Russia's peaceful intentions and desire to focus on its economy and to avoid a new arms race. In his speech on the 60th anniversary of the victory over Nazi Germany, Putin said, quote, "I am convinced that there is no alternative to our friendship and our fraternity with our closest neighbors and all countries of the world. Russia is prepared to build the kind of relationship which is not only based on lessons of the past, but is also directed into a shared future." Close quote. In his 2006 State of the Nation speech, Putin noted that America's military budget is 25 times larger than Russia's. He compared the Bush regime to a wolf who eats whom he wants without listening. Putin is being demonized by U.S. propagandists because he insists upon Russia being a politically and economically independent state. The Bush regime has taken the U.S. outside the boundaries of international law and is acting unilaterally, falsely declaring American military aggression to be defensive and in the interests of peace. Much of the world realizes the hypocrisy and the danger in the Bush regime's justification of the unbridled use of U.S. military power. But no countries except other nuclear powers can challenge American aggression, and then only at the risk of life on Earth. The solution is non-military challenge. The Bush regime's ability to wage war is dependent upon foreign financing. The regime's wars are financed with red ink, which means the hundreds of billions of dollars must be borrowed. As American consumers are spending more than they earn on consumption, the money cannot be borrowed from Americans. The U.S. is totally dependent upon foreigners to finance its budget and trade deficits. By financing these deficits, foreign governments are complicit in the Bush regime's military aggressions and war crimes. The Bush regime's two largest lenders are China and Japan. It is ironic that Japan, the only nation to experience nuclear attack by the U.S., is banker to the Bush regime as it prepares a possible nuclear attack on Iran. If the rest of the world would simply stop purchasing U.S. treasuries and instead dump their surplus dollars into the foreign exchange market, the Bush regime would be overwhelmed with economic crisis and unable to wage war. The arrogant hubris associated with the sole superpower myth would burst like the bubble it is. The collapse of the dollar would also end the U.S. government's ability to subvert other countries by purchasing their leaders to do America's will. The demise of the U.S. dollar is only a question of time. It would save the world from war and devastation if the dollar is brought to its demise before the Bush regime launches its planned attack on Iran. That article by Paul Craig Roberts, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration and former associate editor of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. He's the author of The Tyranny of Good Intentions. That article published at counterpunch.org. You can download this and all previous programs at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. And our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.